It's Diane. On my mind, Congress opens investigations into the January 6th insurrection and is left with more questions than answers. In the first round of testimony, lawmakers heard from Capitol Police in charge of security and D.C. police who were at the scene. The witnesses offered conflicting accounts of what happened that day and pushed blame onto other agencies, leaving many avenues for further investigation, such as what happened to the FBI intelligence warning of a violent assault on the Capitol, and why wasn't the National Guard called in? To talk about what we did and did not learn, I spoke with Ryan Goodman. He's professor of law at New York University's School of Law and co-editor-in-chief of the National Security Online Forum, Just Security. Ryan, the Congress began their investigation into the January 6th insurrection this week. Who did we hear from? What were your reactions?
There was a major hearing in the Senate side where we heard from the former officials who were responsible for Capitol security. So former Sergeant of Arms for the Senate side, former Sergeant at Arms for the House side, and then the former chief of the Capitol Police. So all of the three who were responsible for the lead up and then protection of the Capitol and members of Congress on the 6th. And then we heard afterwards on the House side, primarily from the current acting chief of police. And in some respects, we definitely got more information, and in some respects, more questions were raised than there were answers, including he said, she said. So there are contradictions from those various witnesses in the record. But, you know, for me, I think it's still a significant puzzle. And in one respect, the biggest take-home point for me was the necessity of a January 6th independent commission modeled after the 9/11 commission or something like that, because Congress is starting to do a good job here, but somebody needs to do serious investigative work with subpoena power, requesting documents and other witnesses, fanning out to those other witnesses to get to the bottom of some of these questions.
Of course, there are lots of questions as to just how such a commission would be created. Would it be for Democrats, for Republicans? Would it be outside people altogether? What would you think would make for a reasonable commission to examine what happened?
So I do think that the commission should try to be as bipartisan, or another way I'd put it is nonpartisan, as possible, so that the membership are made up of individuals that are beyond reproach as far as possible, that don't have future political ambitions, that come with some kind of expertise to the table, and that will follow the facts. And so whatever we can do to get as close as possible to that ideal, I'm worried that we live in a terribly different environment, political environment, information environment today than we ever did after 9/11, in which I am worried about who gets put on that commission. I'm worried that of the people that are currently thought about as being the ones who would select the commission members, it's modeled very much after the 9/11 commission, so that the selection would be by Speaker of the House, Minority Leaders, Leader of the Senate, and the Minority Leader, and the President, that they would all have input, and there's different ideas of how you would create the ratio for their input. But I, to be honest, I'm quite worried that the Minority Leader in the House, Kevin McCarthy, might not select the type of people I just described. He himself is potentially implicated in a way in terms of moral responsibility for some of the events on January 6th in the terms of supporting the attempt inside the House to overturn the election results. He has made a very public embrace of President Trump after January 6th. I worry a lot about that. And, you know, I've been doing a bunch of reading about some of the history on the 9/11 Commission. It is interesting that the two chairs, the chair and the vice chair of the 9/11 Commission, wrote a book together. They mentioned at that time that there was actually an informal side agreement for Senator McCain to be able to veto one of the nominees from Senator Lott at the time, the majority leader in the Senate. That might be a nice kind of an accommodation here to try to break through the political impasse. Maybe Representative Cheney should be able to veto one of the proposals by Minority Leader McCarthy. So that's one way to go at it. And then I think another part of our conversation we might talk about a bit is some of the former 9/11 commissioners have been speaking about the importance of unity on the commission and how important it was to have a uniformity among the commissioners publicly. There were dissents and disagreements and debates inside the commission at the time, but that report that came out was signed by all of them. There's no dissenting opinion or concurring opinion. And I think that might be unrealistic in the environment that we're dealing with.
Back to what we heard this week. There was a lot of discussion about the so-called Norfolk memo. What is that and why are there so many questions about it?
Apparently, the FBI did do an analysis before January 6th. And coming out of the Norfolk office, they sent this warning to the Capitol Police, which said, we've been monitoring social media and the like. The people who are coming for this event on January 6th are threatening to attack the Capitol, and they're threatening war, you know, quote unquote war. Now, that has so many different implications. So one implication is the FBI knew, but did they really actually then ratchet up their preparation? From the hearings this week, we've learned that DHS did not increase the level of alert. So that's one big question. And then next week, Senator Klobuchar said that they will have hearings with DHS, FBI, and DOD. So that's an important question to answer. Now, some will say, in response to this idea that there was a warning, that this was raw data, raw intelligence. So raw intelligence meaning it's very crude. It hasn't really been assessed and verified and put through a whole set of protocols before they could then aggregate it with other information and decide on the threat assessment. But an answer to that is, of course, well, sure, of course it's going to be raw intelligence because it's the night before. So that's one answer to it. Now, it's interesting because that, I thought that was one of the most interesting discrepancies in the different hearings, so that the former head of the Capitol Chief of Police, Mr. Sund, in the Senate hearing, referred to it as an intelligence failure on the part of FBI and other U.S. intelligence agencies. He seemed to be suggesting that what is responsible for a large part of the events is this intelligence failure, and therefore they would have done things differently in their preparation had they had that intelligence. Because this email is sent over at 7 p.m. on the night before January 6th. It is not followed up, he also said, and then the current acting DC chief said, you follow that up with a phone call. Like, you don't just send an email at 7 p.m., you know, doctors in hospitals don't just send an email when there's something of an urgent matter with a patient. They sound the alarms and make sure that it gets a response and all the rest of it. So it's an intelligence failure. It's an intelligence coordination failure. So that's one answer to it. On the other hand, this is part of the he said, she said in a certain sense. Maybe this is a matter of subjective perspective, but the current acting head of the Capitol Police, Ms. Pittman, said in a House hearing that she would actually have not done anything differently, that even if they had that information, they already knew that. They already were prepared for that, which is a very different answer. So I think that's what we still, like, in some respect for me, there was more questions were raised than answers were given.
Of course, because, I mean, she could in no way have been prepared for what happened, but rather, it sounds as though the whole group minimized the possibility of what could happen and therefore did not sound the alarm. What about the National Guard, both in advance and the day of the insurrection?
Some of the most explosive revelations, in some sense we already knew about, but we actually had the live testimony from Mr. Sund, the head of the Capitol Police on January 6th. He said he made a formal request on January 4th that they get a declaration of an emergency from the Capitol Police Board and therefore the ability also to get the National Guard, and was rejected.
Was that a written formal request?
Great question. It was not written. So there's a debate about, oh, no, he didn't actually request it. He was just telling us that the National Guard had offered it. But he sticks to the word request. And if he's to be believed, which I think he's quite credible, it's hard to know at the end of the day because there's a lot of contestation here, but they were requesting it ahead of time. And then he also says that he requested it starting around 1:09 p.m. on the day. And he requested that of the sergeant-at-arms over in the Congress, and that he didn't get approval. They did not approve even requesting the National Guard until 2:10 p.m. And then there's a huge delay with the National Guard actually being approved. They're also reporting that they were very surprised to have the Defense Department push back and not give the approval. And so far, the narrative has been that the Defense Department was saying that their hesitance was around optics, the optics of after having the National Guard be involved in some of the egregious activity by U.S. law enforcement over the summer with Black Lives Matter protests and George Floyd protests. They didn't want to have the National Guard in that setting. That's the most charitable explanation that could be possible, but that's their current narrative. So that's another one in which, you know, I'm very eager to see what comes out of the Senate hearing next week.
To what extent would or should the White House have been involved in the whole question of calling up the National Guard?
So there, in some sense, is a straightforward answer, and then it gets a little complicated. So the straightforward answer is that the White House does not need to be involved because they've pre-authorized the Defense Department to do so. So that, not that the Defense Department necessarily has to go to the president and ask for that authorization. They've already kind of, it's pre-approved, delegated in a certain sense. That said, one could easily imagine that the Defense Department did think, well, you know, this is very serious. We're still going to go back to the principal. We're the agent. He's the principal. And ask him, like, here's what we're planning to do. Because there's a lot of reporting from the Washington Post and the New York Times and the like that President Trump was reluctant to give them the authority. And so it's a little bit complicated. Like, what do you mean reluctant to give them the authority unless they actually did try to get it from him? And then we had these statements from the acting Secretary of Defense at the time that he was in communication with the White House. And then he lists all the people conspicuously omitting President Trump. So it sounds like Trump was not actively involved in that. And I think that's what, to me, was also left behind by the impeachment trial, that unfortunately, the House managers had to rely on quote unquote reporting. So reporting by mainstream news organizations with respect to what the president was doing, if he was holding back on the approval of the National Guard, if he was also obviously holding back on making a public statement for his followers to stand down and leave the Capitol. And that, I think, we get that information from a January 6th independent commission.
Do you believe that that commission can actually get to the question of whether the White House was involved in that issue of the National Guard, get to the question of whether President Trump at the time was actually involved?
So I think so, because I think under the threat of perjury, they will have multiple witnesses. I think in a threat of perjury, they will also have multiple witnesses from Congress. And it's not just Kevin McCarthy's phone call. There are multiple members of Congress who called in to try to get the president to act. And there are other people who were former White House officials who were also calling in to try to get him to act or get his family members to have him act. And they weren't getting anywhere with that. And I also think that there will be documented information about what was being transmitted, for example, from the Secret Service, in terms of alerting them to the security of the vice president and the like. And I am also heartened by the precedent that we do have set by the 9/11 Commission. The interesting part also about the 9/11 Commission is it followed a select committee of Senate and House select committee in Congress trying to investigate 9/11, which did not get this information. So the congressional investigation did not get Condoleezza Rice to testify before them. The 9/11 Commission did. The congressional 9/11 investigation did not get the presidential daily briefs that had the explosive bulletin about warning President Bush at the time that Osama bin Laden was planning a strike inside the United States. The 9/11 Commission did. And they got access to all they needed, essentially, from the presidential daily briefs, which is the crown jewels. That's something that no executive branch wants to give up. So I think those are reasons why I'm hopeful or optimistic that a commission will get there. And one of the benefits that a January 6th commission will have that a 9/11 commission did not have is a White House that is more cooperative. So the 9/11 commission was investigating the inactions of President Bush, and he had a White House counsel who was pushing back against the commission time and again. I think the Biden administration needs to just like get out of the way of the commission, and then the commission will be able to do a good job. They don't, but instead, you know, the 9/11 commission actually had an obstacle, pushback from the Bush White House. So I think that's actually reasons why I think that the January 6th commission can actually give the public a true history and record of what occurred.
Right. And considering the state of today's political atmosphere, it sounds as though, to me, you are being very optimistic about that commission and what we could learn. Do you really have that much faith that we will learn what we should know?
So for me, I think everything turns on the membership of the commission. So who are the human beings who have those positions? And it's funny, some parts of this actually come from empirical social science work I used to do on commissions around the world. And they all had different kinds of powers, but the one thing that made the biggest difference was the character of the leaders of the commissions, because they could do so many things with their informal and formal powers. So I think that so much turns on that. So I do worry that Kevin McCarthy puts into place people who are invested in the big lie, that we just have a very corrupt, bankrupt commission, and maybe we'll know that starting out the gate, so that I'll give up my optimism quite quickly. So I think that's one piece of it. I also think that I agree with you in the sense that even if the commission produces a high quality report that does give us the information, it's not like we live in a world in which there's one audience that is just looking for the facts and will metabolize the facts into their understanding of the world. And I also think between now and the commission producing any kind of report, you have to calculate in to the equation Donald Trump saying the 10 angry Democrats who are running the commission, regardless of the fact that five of them will be Republicans. So there will be a huge disinformation campaign, I have to assume, coming out of him. And then the loyalists that he has. So those are my greatest worries. And then the other worry I have, which I hinted at earlier, some of the 9/11 commissioners have written and said, you know, one of the secret ingredients that worked for them was this unanimity. Because with unanimity, they could produce a report that had public credibility. And I think that is living in a different world. I don't think we're in that world. And if anything, there are actual historical documentations of people who were on the 9/11 commission, and they said that, and I find this to be one of the most interesting pieces, that unanimity meant that they were not going to point the finger at officials for wrongdoing. You can't get that because you're not going to get the Republican side, all of them, all of the Republican members of the commission to agree to that. And so I think that that might be something going in that they should just realize that they're not going to achieve this through unanimity to get the real truth out.
Do we know anything more about why 35 Capitol Police officers are under investigation?
So we don't really. The question was asked in these hearings, but we didn't get a satisfactory response except to say that they are under investigation. If I recall, the timeline might be something like 60 or 90 days that there was an expectation from the acting Capitol Police chief that they would report to Congress on the results of these investigations. It sounds like some of them are, we've gotten some reporting from members of Congress saying this to reporters on record, that some of it is what we saw visually, you know, the Capitol Police officer taking a selfie with the insurrectionists, rioters, members of the mob. one of them donning a MAGA hat and quote unquote beginning to give directions. I always find that funny, but beginning to give directions, not then giving directions to some of the rioters, like through the directions through the halls of the Capitol. And then some of it, I think, might also be about social media posts that some of these Capitol officers were involved in that would suggest sympathies to the insurrectionists. Yeah, and just to label another one, you know, we also know of an investigation of a Secret Service member based on their social media posts that expressed deep sympathies for the insurrectionists.
And do we know anything more about who it was who allowed tours of the Capitol on January 5th, among whom were some of those who later became part of the riot group?
One member of Congress has said explicitly that the new representative, Boebert, was one of the people who she or her staff, but I think she, gave these quote-unquote tours on January 5th. The only other piece of this that we know, that we actually learned this week, is that there is video footage of these events that has been that is being investigated by the Justice Department and the DC office. And unfortunately, we don't know anything further about it.
Who needs to be called to further testify? Who do we need to hear from?
There are two big pieces of the puzzle that I, at least in my estimation, we need to hear from. Number one is Christopher Wray. I mean, there's a little bit of a hashtag going around on social media, where is Wray? I participated in that. I can't fathom a good reason why we haven't heard from him in a public press conferences and the like. I could fathom a reason before January 20th that maybe he didn't want to be out in front publicly because he would then anger President Trump, and then President Trump could still fire him until January 20th or stymie their investigation and the like. After January 20th, I thought, okay, here's a plausible explanation if I just had to speculate, which is he doesn't want to be out in front publicly until the impeachment trial is wrapped up, because then it looks like the FBI is potentially interfering in a highly political process. Now, I've run out of explanations, but on the other hand, Senator Klobuchar said that next week we'll hear from FBI, DHS, and DOD. She did not name names. I can only hope that we would hear from the head of the FBI, not some subordinate. And there, I think we also want to hear from him, not just about what they knew, but also what's the status of the investigation in terms of the criminal investigations and the like. I'd also, I definitely would think that one of the most important pieces to the puzzle is what the president was doing in the White House on the day of January 6th when the insurrection was ongoing. And then there are a lot of people that they could ask.
Well, we actually saw footage of the president watching this group of people marching toward the Capitol on this huge television screen, along with many of his associates, including his son and his girlfriend, the girlfriend dancing in front of the camera as all this was going on. We also know that Kevin McCarthy called the president asking for help because, of course, the vice president was there in the Capitol in danger. And the president said something like, well, it's clear that these people who are there care more about the election I won than you do. So we do know what the president was doing, at least in those few moments on film.
So I agree with you that we actually know the answer. So we know the answer. And we know the answer. There are other sources of information as well. Republican Senator Ben Sasse says on a radio show that he's spoken to senior White House aides, and they say that President Trump was excited by what he saw, delighted by what he saw, couldn't understand why other people in the White House weren't as delighted and excited by what he saw. New York Times, Washington Post. He was saying the same thing, reporting that he was pleased by it. And we also know the timing of other things. Like, it took forever for him to finally issue a statement that said, not just for them to be peaceful, but to actually leave the grounds. So at first he was even just saying, like, the one that was a quasi good statement, but also took a lot of effort to get that out of him. And many other senior Republican elected officials had already been tweeting and saying, get these people out, and were pleading with him on Twitter to make a statement, and he didn't do it. So I think you're right. We know, we do know the answer, but much of that is somewhat indirect. I think the video, he would say, you know, what's the timing of that video? Of course, I knew they were marching over there. I even told them to march over there, but that's all I wanted them to do. So I think that one, there's a plausible deniability or an answer to it. But the other pieces, I mean, it could be very significant to have Kevin McCarthy testify under oath in a public setting. And it's not like, you know, just going back to the 9/11 Commission example, the 9/11 Commission interviewed Vice President Cheney, and he was vice president at the time. So the idea that we can't get Vice President Pence now to be interviewed under oath, the 9/11 Commission had the Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld testify publicly, Condoleezza Rice, which is even more remarkable because she's a national security advisor who was not Senate confirmed. So it's like a close aide to the president publicly testify. I think that vivid public testimony maybe helps set more of a historical record and understanding, and the visibility of it reaches Americans or speaks to Americans in a more undeniable way. That's my hope. But I agree with you. We know. And we just had an impeachment trial. There is no answer to that. I remember the moment when, I forget who joined her question, but Senator Murkowski's question asks, in the question and answer period, Trump's lawyer, this question about what was he doing in the White House. And his answer is basically that your question is irrelevant. It lacks legal relevance. It's like, he doesn't read it. We know in so many ways it can't answer the question because it's so damning.
More of my conversation with Ryan Goodman when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Ryan Goodman. He's professor of law at New York University School of Law and co-editor-in-chief of the national security online forum, Just Security. There was also testimony Tuesday about the role of white supremacists in the attack. As arrests are made, what are we learning about who was involved?
I think of there being two different types of people, at least, and you could kind of even segregate it into further than that, but two types of people. One is people who spontaneously were caught up in the moment and inspired to storm the Capitol based on the president's remarks at the Ellipse and the like, and part of the mob. And they never necessarily came that morning knowing that this is what they were going to be doing that day. And they committed federal crimes and the rest of it by storming the Capitol, being inside the Capitol and the like. So that it wasn't pre-planned. But then there's a second group, and those are right-wing militia, white supremacist groups, the Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, and others. And that definitely seems to be a lot of pre-planning, and the Justice Department is now actually bringing conspiracy charges against some of them. And we have evidence from the Justice Department about their thinking beforehand and them coming with military equipment and the like, and their level of communication and coordination. So part of it was not pre-planned, and I think some of it was a pre-planned military-style, paramilitary-style operation by white supremacist groups.
And yet some Republicans have argued that it was Antifa that really was behind the whole process, and that it was a friendly group with no intention of doing anything more than gathering together.
That's right. I think one of the most, I'm trying to find the right word, this is somewhat being charitable, disreputable moments in the hearings this past week was Senator Ron Johnson spouting that very false conspiracy theory, the way that you just described it. And none of the witnesses would agree with him. They contradicted him on it immediately. And none of it is consistent with all of the Justice Department indictments and criminal offense statements. We know with overwhelming evidence and the highest degree of certainty you could possibly have that these were Trump supporters. Many of them came from the Ellipse, and some of them were already pre-positioned outside of the Capitol. And that is the overwhelming percentage of people who did this and engaged in what was an insurrection.
And apparently far-right insignia was spotted on clothing, badges, flags, and taking the Confederate flag into the Capitol itself.
Yes, and that reminds me of something I thought to say in response to your prior question about white supremacists. I mean, to me, I think that we should also understand the dimensions of white supremacy, that it's not just these right-wing militia groups that are the white supremacists inside that Capitol building. There's a lot of white supremacy going on with respect to a lot of those people, even the sporadic people acting in the moment, and the person carrying the Confederate flag and others, and the deep anti-Semitism of some of the people, you know, wearing T-shirts that sent like 6 million Jews were not enough. That's what the T-shirt is a sign of for the Holocaust. And then it also goes to something else you had also mentioned, which is, you know, going back to the prior question about the kind of intelligence failure and what happened with this Norfolk assessment. And the NPR reporting, which is the first to have broken some of that story, had interviewed some of the people who said they seem to admit it was actually a bias on their part, that the reason why they minimized the threat. And the bias is that they saw the Trump supporters more like themselves. And they don't have enough racial diversity inside the FBI and the like. And I think that's part of why the intelligence failure happened in terms of minimization of the threat. The law enforcement response on the day in which people were treated with kid gloves, and we have the image of the woman being escorted out the building, held by her hand so she doesn't stumble, compared to the draconian use of force against George Floyd protesters, peaceful George Floyd protesters. So I think the white supremacist dimensions of this have sometimes come up in these hearings, but my goodness, given how significant it is, they have not been given their due. That issue has not been given its due.
What can you tell us about the Oath Keepers and their leader? What are we learning about her?
A couple things about them. So one thing that differentiates the Oath Keepers from others is that they explicitly try to recruit their members from former law enforcement and military, which makes them a much greater threat. And then part of what we're also learning from the Justice Department's filings in criminal court is not only that it was pre-planned, that some of the individuals, at a minimum, also thought they were taking their signal directly from Donald Trump. So that when Donald Trump tweets, January 6th, come, it's going to be wild, we actually have their communications with each other saying, the president says it's on. And we have communications from them beforehand saying, I don't want to go unless the president approves it, because otherwise it's not authorized or something like that. So Donald Trump's signaling to them, I think, is very significant. And the other one is the Proud Boys also took their signals from Donald Trump. And I think one of the other parts of the record that's so important is something of omission, not commission, that the president of the United States never says to those groups, do not come, you are not welcome here. So when he made his announcement, come to January 6th, it's going to be wild, the Proud Boys announced publicly they will be coming to January 6th. And you would think that obviously, like, now that we have a normal presidency, President Biden would say, you are not welcome to come. You should not be at the event. And instead, Trump is silent on that. And when he says his incendiary rhetoric, he must know that standing in that crowd are Proud Boys and Oath Keepers.
There's been lots of talk about the CPAC gathering this weekend and President Trump's appearance there. I was rather taken aback when Mitch McConnell, now the Senate Minority Leader, was asked whether he would support the presidential attempt by Donald Trump in 2024. And he said most definitely he would. I was rather stunned at that after the speech that McConnell gave on the floor of the Senate after the conviction failed. Did that surprise you that he's ready to vote for Donald Trump again?
Yes. I mean, it's shocking. His speech on the floor of the Senate, I thought was an historic speech. At the time, I thought it was a historic speech. And partly because I think his speech is even stronger than Senator Schumer's speech in its condemnation for President Trump's actions. And he even makes an explicit reference to the fact that Trump might be held criminally liable for his gross misconduct. So to turn around from saying somebody's morally and practically responsible for the insurrection that tried to overturn an election and interrupt the peaceful transfer of power in our country and should be looked at by criminal authorities, and then to turn around and say, and I will support him to become president and have that power back again. I can't believe we live in that world. My only hope, I'll say, is that he is hedging and he still sees the best interests of the country and his own party's best interests as being one that severs Trumpism and President Trump. And this was his way of hedging it. Like, he knows that if he doesn't say, I will support the nominee, whoever they are, of the Republican Party, he doesn't have as much influence to try to get the Republican Party out of the situation it's in with Trumpism. But that, you know, how can I place any faith in that? And just one last piece on that. There's been an analysis recently done on how autocrats who are thrown out of power around the world come back to power, maintain a form of power. And one of the most important ingredients is their connection to their allies in the legislature. And so I worry a lot that either Trump will potentially try to regain power or pick his successors and control one of the two main parties in our country because of the weakness of people like Mitch McConnell, and that there are not enough people like Liz Cheney left in the Republican Party.
And therefore, I find myself wondering that even if a kind of commission that you would ideally see come forward, will the country, the part of the country that voted for and continues to believe in Donald Trump, accept the findings of such a commission? Will it matter to them at all if the commission does in fact find that Donald Trump could have done things to stop what happened on January 6th?
There are a couple different ways I think about it. One is, I do think that there are members of the Republican Party who have a vested interest in more Americans and more Republicans understanding the truth of the matter and coming around. So that includes the 7 Republican senators who voted to convict. That includes Mitch McConnell, I think, because he does want to free the Republican Party of Trump, it seems like. And that's what his true interests are for the Republican Party. So they might have some broader support in that regard. The second piece of it that I think about is that there's sociological studies coming out of Yale, in part, that say that the way that you can try to convince somebody otherwise is going to filter all kinds of factual information through their political and cultural priors is by having people who they identify with telling them the truth. And so I do think that's why witness testimony, live witness testimony before a commission of Republicans like Mike Pence or like Mike Pence's chief of staff, if they are forced to tell the truth under penalty of perjury, or the other people they know, there are other witnesses who will tell the truth, maybe that penetrates. And I think the last piece that I think about is also a failing of the impeachment trial, but I don't think there's anything the House managers, well, there's limited things the House managers could have done, which is, according to the social science surveys, people who see what President Trump did and what the insurrectionists did and are not critical of that. They actually think they're more sympathetic to what happened on January 6th. It's dependent in large part on the fact that they have bought into the big lie. So I think a threshold issue is to defeat the big lie. I worry that big lie is like the stab in the back that motivated the rise of fascism after World War I and into World War II. It's the same as the lost cause in the Civil War that was a mobilizing myth for white supremacists, and we have the big lie. So I think you have to defeat the big lie to then get to a situation where people can actually start to accept more the facts and the truth about what happened on January 6th. And that's why I think, like, the House managers, how much could they actually defeat the big lie in that moment? But maybe that's what the commission can do.
And the big lie that Trump won the election is still out there.
Yes. And according to the wonderful fact checker at CNN, Daniel Dale, this morning at CPAC, they started displaying a video, and the video is reproducing the big lie that the election was stolen. So we have CPAC doing that on February 26, 2021. And the other piece of it that's so frightening to me is that the Department of Homeland Security, almost an exact month ago, on January 27th, issued a very unusual terrorist warning that said there is a threat around the country that is the very people who, and the groups, these white supremacist groups that are responsible for, in part, for January 6th, are mobilized by false narratives that are still being perpetuated, meaning the big lie. So we have the Department of Homeland Security giving us this most unusual terrorist alert for the country based on the fact that the big lie is fueling, that's their word, domestic violent extremists. And then CPAC, as an organization, perpetuates the big lie and invites President Trump to give his speech, which I'm sure will, you know, resurface or continue the perpetuation of the big lie. And that's the situation that we're currently in.
And that threat of danger extends to President Biden's State of the Union address and what protections are going to have to be taken there at the Capitol at that time.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there was something else from the hearings this week that I was somewhat dismayed by, which were some of the Republican members of Congress, Senator Scott was one in particular, bemoaning the physical infrastructure that's being put up by law enforcement around the Capitol and asking when it will be taken down and saying, is there any reason for it? And he's also asking very cleverly, potentially, the former officials who cannot say what the reason is because they're not in the loop. So they're like, oh, I don't know. But, so you don't know. You don't have a reason. And then we have the current acting chief of the Capitol Police in the House hearings say exactly what you just described, which is they have specific threat information that these groups are planning to conduct a mass casualty event against the Capitol whenever Biden gives his speech. So it's an imminent threat that is still with us in a very palpable way.
Ryan, on that note, that sad note, we'll leave it and hope to talk with you once again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was Ryan Goodman. He's professor of law at New York University School of Law and co-editor-in-chief of the National Security Online Forum, Just Security. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've written in to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Allison Brody, and Sandra Baker. Our engineer is Steve Lack. Thanks for listening, all. Be well, stay safe. I'm Diane Raine.